case? You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Anand Ramana. With me is Betsy Hudson Goodall and Robert Lofton. We're lawyers with the law firm of McGuire Woods, and we represent Navarre Incorporated on this appeal. Mr. Chief Justice, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time.
Three.
This is an appeal of a seven-figure judgment entered by the Fairfax County Circuit Court. And in our papers, we advance a number of arguments challenging the judgments on counts 1, which is a breach of a non-disclosure agreement, and count 7, which is a violation of the Trade Secrets Act. But the centerpiece issue in this appeal is the focus of the cross-appeal that's been lodged by the plaintiffs in this case, FBC and WWS, challenging the judgment notwithstanding the verdict that the court entered on count 2. Count 2 is the breach of the teaming agreement. The issue there in the cross-appeal is whether the teaming agreement is enforceable as a matter of law. And after the jury was discharged, the trial court correctly concluded that the teaming agreement upon which the plaintiff sued is unenforceable because the business deal that is articulated in it, and the one that was to form the basis of the subcontract, the follow-on subcontract after award of the prime contract, was too vague. So, of course, that post-trial decision of the teaming agreement affects and, in fact, nullifies the verdict on count 2. But it would seem, however, that that conclusion, that correct conclusion, also affects the liability and damages portions of count 1 and count 7. In both of those counts, in counts 1 and 7, the plaintiffs allege that Navarre, for instance, breached the non-disclosure agreement, not in its disclosure of information in May 2011 during the procurement process, but rather simply when our client and their clients failed to enter into that subcontract, that very subcontract that the court later found to be unenforceable as a matter of law. Same thing for the Trade Secrets Act, that there's a Trade Secret Act violation and that the jury found and the court entered judgment on a trade secret violation, not on a misappropriation during the procurement process. The parties worked fine together during the procurement process, but only upon the fact that the parties did not enter into that unenforceable into the business deal that formed that was too vague to begin with. So what we have here now before this court is an inconsistent judgment entered by Fairfax County. On the one hand, you have a teaming agreement count, which was correctly decided, where the teaming agreement required the parties to negotiate in good faith and enter into a subcontract. That was deemed to be unenforceable, and so the court concluded that the subcontract was too vague. On the other hand, where Fairfax County agreed in imposing liability on our client for failing to do just that, for failing to enter into that subcontract. So all roads in this case lead back to the teaming agreement, whether it's unenforceable. And we're not asking the court to change any law here. We relied clearly on the Schaefer case, this court's 1997 decision in the Schaefer case, which really just echoes basic contract law in this Commonwealth, that a contract is enforceable if it has reasonable terms. It's unenforceable if it's merely an agreement to agree. It doesn't contain reasonable terms that the parties have agreed on. And that's exactly what's happened in this teaming agreement.
Counsel, would it be helpful to look at, I guess it's paragraph 5 in the teaming agreement. That seems to be the one that sets out the agreement. And maybe walk us through that and tell us why you think it's an agreement to agree as opposed to an enforceable contract.
Your Honor is exactly right. Paragraph 5 is great evidence of why this is just an agreement to agree. The language here, it says, if Prime is awarded a contract or contracts, the Prime agrees to offer a subcontract, doesn't say what, there's no subcontract attached to it, to the subcontractor, the clients, covering such work in accord, and that work is articulated later in the agreement, but vaguely. This next sentence right here is really what shows that this is just an agreement to agree. The parties agree to promptly negotiate in good faith and upon arriving at prices, terms, and conditions acceptable to the parties to enter into equitable subcontracts. That right there says we haven't really discussed prices, we haven't discussed terms, we haven't discussed conditions, but we'll do that at a later date. There's other evidence of that too. There's more evidence that's not contained in this team agreement that should be. There's an integration clause in this contract. There's no discussion whatsoever about the division of scope of work between our clients and their clients. There's no discussion whatsoever between the division of labor between their two clients. I'm talking about substantive scope of work. What kinds of events are we going to handle? What kinds of events are they going to handle? There's a provision that talks later in Exhibit A about work share, but it's only between our clients and their clients. And the vagueness of that was apparent to the circuit court as well, up to 49%. It wasn't near 49%. It wasn't 47, 48, 49%. It was up to 49%. And the record reflects that they actually realized this later on when they tried to renegotiate this teaming agreement to say 49%. And we didn't agree.
So in theory, under the original 0 to 49%, you could have said, well, 10% is all we're willing to agree to.
And in these, we have these cases a lot up in Northern Virginia, and that's a lot of times that's what happens, because the government will award these prime contractors and then adjust the proposals accordingly so that even if you were to propose someone at 49%, the reason we can't enter into an agreement that gives you 49% is because sometimes the government comes back, and then the prime contractor is stuck in between the government and the direction from the government, and then it's contractual obligation to the subcontractors, and they're liable to the subcontractors even though the government has directed them to do that. So you're absolutely right, Your Honor. It could have been 10%, it could have been 15, 20, 30, 40. The problem with teaming agreements in Virginia, and this is a big problem up where we practice, is many times they're unenforceable. They need to be reasonably...
But the parties sort of know that commercially going into it. It's a risk they take.
It is a risk they take, and in part of this appeal hopefully will resolve what needs to be reasonably certain. If we could identify... Because it's not going to be perfect. The cyber law case, for instance, says, well, you should attach the subcontract. As a practical matter, that can't happen in government contracting, federal government contracting.
Well, if you're not dealing with a UCC case and you're dealing with a common law contract, and this would be a common law contract, you've got to have scope, you've got to have price, you've got to have duration.
That's right. And if there are prices, even subject to some sort of formal mechanism, price subject to government adjustment, scope of work subject to government adjustment, work share subject, and then put more precise terms in, then I think these teaming agreements can be enforceable. But this has none of that in it. So this teaming agreement is unenforceable insofar as it requires our client to enter into a subcontract later on, after the prime contract award. And even, there's evidence in the record that that's exactly what happened in this case. They pitched the government together, right, and the government changed the scope of this entire procurement from a $10, $11 million procurement to a $55 million procurement. There's not a lot of evidence in the record of substantively what was added, if it was a number of events, or if there were more substantive elements to that. But that's exactly why these need to be somewhat vague. But Your Honor's right, it's a risk that the businesses run when they enter into these teaming agreements. However, it's one that I think needs a little bit of clarification so that it lessens the business risk, not just for the prime contractors, but also for the subcontractors. If we know what types of reasonably certain terms need to be articulated in these teaming agreements, I think that businesses could probably be better.
Isn't the general rule, as long as there's a formula or some objective criteria that you can reference, and that can fill in the ambiguities?
I think that would work. I'm not aware of any case that says that. I think Schaefer, most of these teaming agreement cases are case-by-case bases, and they just simply apply basic Virginia law that say you need reasonably certain terms. But if there was something that articulated scope of work or work share, prices, incorporating FAR clauses, subject to some formal mechanism, I think that makes it enforceable. Again, that's not what we have here.
Counsel, part of their argument seems to be that there was an obligation to negotiate, and that negotiations did not take place. Could that obligation to negotiate be a breach of the contract if it did, in fact, did not take place?
No, because I think that what the case law says is Schaefer says that's an unenforceable obligation. That there can be no legally enforceable obligation simply to negotiate, because really all that is agreeing to agree in the future. And so there's what could come out of that, because then what we have is just an obligation to bad faith negotiations, good faith negotiations, how many negotiations are there? And so this court has said in Schaefer and in other cases that no, we're just not going to enforce that. If you want to have a subcontract, the Agostini case that's cited by the appellees in this case is a good example. If you want to have a follow-on subcontract, you need to have reasonably certain terms contained in the letter agreement in that case or the teaming agreement in this case. But just to say we'll do this in the future, you're not really agreeing to anything at all. You're not agreeing to scope of work share, prices, terms and conditions, anything. So here in this case, what we have is a teaming agreement that is unenforceable as a matter of law. But that matters for the non-disclosure agreement counts, as I said, in the Trade Service Act. Trade Secrets Act claim as well. Because what it does is it takes this obligation that they sued on and that the court imposed a judgment on in the non-disclosure agreement, a vague one at best, that the information shall be, this is paragraph 2 and 5, shall be maintained in confidence by the receiving party and not disclosed by the receiving party to any third parties not intended nor otherwise used by the recipient for any purpose inconsistent with the intentions of the parties as stated herein. What the intentions of the parties stated herein is articulated by the appellees in this case is, well, you didn't give us a subcontract. But we know that we have no legally enforceable contractual obligation to enter into a subcontract. Yet a liability has been imposed on us on this vague statement that is a catch-all statement that now requires us to simply enter into a subcontract. What subcontract, we don't know because it wasn't clearly articulated. So that is the basis of liability under their NDA theory. But we also know that we didn't really do anything to breach even that. They, on the stand, WWS, one of the appellees, admitted that they have no evidence of that we used the information in performing the contract. FBC, on the stand, admitted that they have no evidence that we have used the information for future procurements. So the only evidence, really, is that we worked together during this procurement to obtain the prime contract. And it was only when the negotiations failed that they said, well, that's the breach then. Everything was fine. They presented all their information. We didn't present it at all. That the breach was literally failing to enter into that subcontract, an unenforceable obligation under count 2. I see that I only have 13 seconds left, so I'll probably just wait to start my damages argument.
All right, you have 3 minutes and 8 seconds left.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ed Tolchin, and I represent the appellees in this case, WWS and FBC. Listening to Mr. Romano's argument, I have to start with the following, that these two contracts are independent. One does not require the other. You start with, was there a breach of the confidentiality agreement? Second is, was there a breach of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act? And the third is the teaming agreement enforceable as a matter of law? We win on items 1 or 2, regardless of 3. In other words, they're just not connected. They're independent contracts. The first two issues about the Trade Secrets Act and the confidentiality agreement were decided by a jury who listened to days of evidence, who looked at the documents, and came to a conclusion that there was a breach of the confidentiality agreement, and that breach caused the damages that the jury ended up awarding to us. The third issue about the teaming agreement is an issue of law. And respectfully, I think on the first two issues, this court is bound by the jury's factual determinations. It can't go back and revisit those factual determinations. Those were disputed facts. The jury heard them, made a decision, and that should end the matter on the issue of the breach of the confidentiality agreement and the damages and the Uniform Trade Secrets Act issue. With respect to the teaming agreement, I will agree that that is an issue of law, and what Judge Kasabian did below is that he held as a matter of law, no teaming agreement is ever enforceable. And when he did that, he made a mistake because he didn't look at this particular teaming agreement. And all he did is he applied what he thought was the law from CyberLock, a federal court decision, that said that essentially teaming agreements are unenforceable, relying on your decision in Schaefer. But your decision in Schaefer never said that. So what has happened, as Mr. Romano has told you, is that this has become a big issue now in Northern Virginia and elsewhere, because what happens is that everybody now looks at CyberLock and says, sorry, teaming agreements are completely unenforceable based upon under Virginia law. And they cite Schaefer without ever going back and reading Schaefer, because Schaefer never says that. It was just a mistake made by the federal judge.
Well, counsel, can you tell me why this is teaming agreement that's enforceable?
Sure. Look at the teaming agreement. Let me pull it out of here. First of all, there are two parts to this teaming agreement. In Section 5, as you pointed out, the first sentence says that they shall offer us a subcontract. That is a completely separate section. The second section is that they shall negotiate some of the terms of that contract. The requirement that they offer us a subcontract is a legally enforceable clause. And in fact, there is a provision in here that says that if one clause is unenforceable, that doesn't affect the enforceability of other clauses. So we have a legally enforceable
contract. Suppose I had a contract that said, I shall sell my property to you. I shall. Not may, not thinking about it. I'm going to and I shall.
Right.
But we'll agree later on what property it is. We'll agree later on how much you should pay for it, and we'll agree later on how we should finance it.
That's not what we have here. What we have here is a section, for example, talking about price. Look at Section 3D. Section 3D says subcontractors shall be bound by the prices, terms, conditions, and commitments set forth in this proposal. So we have the construct of what was going to be the basis of this subcontract.
But we're still going from 0 to 49% of the scope of the crime that will be subbed out.
Okay, and if you look at the record shows that, first of all, it doesn't really say up to 49%. What it does is it says a minimum of 51%. It says it from the opposite
end.
Okay.
But 0 to 51.
It says at a minimum, prime will receive at a minimum 51% of the labor hours and labor dollars in accordance with Directive 8A awards. That language there, in accordance with Directive 8A awards, is critical, because as the testimony came out and as it was explained to the jury and as the jury found, there is this rule out there, and we provided it in our appellee's brief. The rule says that the prime contractor has to have at least 51% of the work when it is a directed award such as in this case. Now, everybody knows that you can't split a human body in half. And sometimes it goes a little bit this way and sometimes it goes a little bit this way, because things can't be split totally correctly. So therefore, as long as there is 51% plus a little bit more, that's fine. And nobody really cares about it. But it's about 51%. That's what that language means. The language is not 0 to 51%.
Right.
The language is
not...
Can
I ask you one more question? An 8A contract, a set-aside contract?
8A is the Small Business Administration's minority set-aside contract.
So a FAR set-aside contract, you got to have 51% for the eligible party. I may not be using the right terms.
The eligible party has to have at least 51% of the
All right,
cost.
So the eligible party could have 52% or 53% or 60%, and that would still be consistent with FAR and the 8A program, right?
Correct.
All right, so what does it say? It could be 75 or 80 or 90% here.
It can't be, because that's not the industry usage which came out. The jury was instructed to interpret a contract based upon custom and usage in the industry. Custom and usage in the industry, which came into evidence, was that this language means approximately 51-49. And in fact, the testimony from Navarre itself was that we understood that this language means approximately 51-49, as close as we can get to it. That was the testimony of everybody. Everybody said that. And that is the custom and usage of the industry. And the jury was instructed, without objection, to interpret it based upon custom and usage in the industry. And they did. But again, that has nothing to do with the confidentiality agreement, because the confidentiality agreement has another provision. That confidentiality agreement says that you are required to use the information solely for a joint contract. How that contract was going to be divided was going to be, according to the testimony of the parties, 5149 or as close as possible, wholly apart, independent from the teaming agreement. We gave them our information to go win a joint contract. And the confidentiality agreement says, as clear as a bell, you are limited to the use of the confidential information that we gave to you, Navarre. And Navarre instead took our confidential information and instead of using it solely for the limited use purpose that we gave it to them, which was getting a joint contract, they used it to get a contract solely for Navarre.
Did they use it or did you use it? My understanding was that your client presented your information in the conference where you were attempting to get this contract.
Navarre testified at trial that they led the presentation to the government. If you look at the presentation,
they led the presentation, but wasn't there evidence that your client made 90% of the presentation presenting your evidence?
The presentation is contained in at JA 581 through wherever it ends. That presentation is 90% from my clients. What happened is that that information is quintessential confidential information that my clients gave to Navarre. Navarre puts it on its letterhead, so to speak, and it takes that presentation, and we all go to the government and we say, this is the presentation of our group to try to get this contract. So they used our confidential information. Was my client there? Absolutely. But the purpose of everybody being there was for the limited purpose of using this to get a joint contract. And in fact, if you look at the confidentiality agreement, it says absolutely clearly, unequivocally, that, and this is at, turn the page here, this is at paragraph 2, the recipient, that's Navarre, shall not use and shall not permit any others to use such information in violation of any laws, including securities laws, or in any other manner detrimental to the disclosing party, such as the development of any product or service for itself or for any other purposes.
Can I ask you this question? It seems to me that what you're saying is that the parties agreed to make this presentation, this joint presentation, with the understanding that the contract was going to come back and be negotiated with your client. Is that correct? After Navarre got the prime contract, they come back and negotiate with your client. That's your understanding.
The presentation was on the theory that everybody would participate in this contract that would be awarded. The way that it would have to be set up legally is that we would be the subcontractor. Navarre would be the
contractor. Let me finish my question then. What I'm trying to ask you is that some later point in time, you allege Navarre did not go through with it.
Navarre never offered us a subcontract.
But you're saying it was not an improper disclosure at the time it was made, but sometime later when they didn't follow through and offer you a subcontract to the prime contract, it then became, it related back and became an improper disclosure.
No. Actually, the evidence showed that at the point that we made the presentation, Navarre already knew it wasn't going to offer us a subcontract. It directed its, when we had one of their employees testify under subpoena, that she was directed, the program manager was directed to have no communications with my client. Zero. To cut my client out. Cut my clients out. So the breach was from day one. But again, the breach under the confidentiality agreement is using that information to get anything other than a joint contract. They use that information to get a single, solitary contract just for Navarre. That is the breach in and of itself. You never have to get to anything else. That's all you. That's all the jury had.
The final piece for you then would be: it doesn't matter whether the second agreement was valid or not. Their failure to come back and offer you a subcontract was enough to trigger this.
Under the confidentiality agreement, that is correct. And that's why I say they're completely independent. It just so happens we have the belt and suspenders. We have the confidentiality agreement, which gives us these rights, and we have the teaming agreement, which gives us these rights.
I'm still confused. You have the confidentiality agreement, which says we will work together to get this government contract. But then you have the teaming agreement, which says if the prime is awarded a contract, then we will work together to negotiate a contract. And so one does appear to be dependent on the other. You give them permission to use your information, and then you will attempt to negotiate a contract. Where is the analysis? That analysis
because we could throw away the teaming agreement. We never needed a teaming agreement. We had a confidentiality agreement. And in fact, in many situations in government contracting, you don't have a teaming agreement. What you have is people working together on a confidentiality agreement. And they use the information based upon the confidentiality agreement to go and get some work. They have an agreement that if they get the work, then everybody's going to participate in it, and that's the confidentiality agreement.
Okay.
The teaming agreement is intended to give some flesh and bones as to how the process will be in the future, but it is irrelevant to the enforceability.
How can it be irrelevant if it says if the prime is awarded a contract, basically my word, not yours, then we will negotiate how we're going to work together, what the subcontract is going to look like.
Let's assume we didn't have the teaming agreement. Remove the teaming agreement from this. We still have a confidentiality agreement that limits their use to getting a joint contract.
Okay,
they breached that.
Let's stop that. Let's stop right there. That statement, they breached that. Okay, you go in to make a presentation, all three parties. The presentation is made. There's no evidence that their intention at the time was to not enter into a contract with you. The evidence shows that at some future date, they did not enter into a contract. But I'm reading the language here that says, otherwise used by the recipient for any purpose inconsistent with the intentions of the parties as stated herein. So at the time they used it, there's no evidence that their intention was inconsistent.
No.
Is there any evidence that on that day they did not, never intended to enter into a contract with you?
Respectfully, we're not asserting a fraud claim. If we were asserting a fraudulent inducement claim, that would be a question. But we are asserting a breach of contract claim.
I understand that. But the question is, on the day that they used it, was the contract breached?
On the day that they used it, the contract was breached, yes.
How? How was it breached at the time of the presentation to the government?
Because at the time of the presentation to the government, they used that information to obtain a contract solely for Navarre. That you're saying the contract wasn't awarded until later. That's true. That's true. But the breach itself occurred when they use that information to get a contract.
How can it be that information that is disclosed with everybody seeing, everybody knowing it's being disclosed, with everybody agreeing that it's being disclosed, somehow becomes an improper disclosure later when it's married up with a subsequent breach by one of the parties?
I think that happens every day. I think
can you give me a case that is on all fours factually with what you just said, where there is a disclosure on a particular date, there is a breach on a later date that causes the completed disclosure to be wrongful?
Okay. First of all, we're not dealing with disclosure, we're dealing with use, and that makes all the difference in the world. And the best example would be, look at the Trade Secrets Act, the language of the Trade Secrets Act. If you look there...
I'm looking at a mutual agreement not to disclose. Does that not deal with disclosure?
It deals with disclosure and use. This is like a protective order in a piece of litigation.
Well, again, all I want is a case that says that a completed disclosure that was proper and agreed upon on one date can then subsequently become wrongful because of a subsequent breach.
But
in any case.
Again, I don't know of a case that deals with disclosure, but with use, and that's what this, I understand it's called disclosure, but this restricts both use and disclosure. And with respect to use, that can occur and it occurs all the time.
Still haven't heard the name of a case. That's what he asked.
I don't have a case, okay. But I can point you to the Trade Secrets Act, which explicitly in its language talks about limited use. A misappropriation is defined as violating an agreement as to limited use. And that's what a misappropriation is. You misappropriate it when you have an agreement that says, I limit my use to this, and then later on you use it, and then you use it for something else. That is the definition of a misappropriation in the statute, and I think it's the same thing here. You have the same. You have the same issue. In any event, if you
that's
get
me,
to
your question.
If you.
Better stated. Are you through tangling?
Yes.
Okay. Your time has expired.
That's 204 over. Okay.
That's right.
Number of issues, if I could respond to the answer to your question. That was raised by Justice Kelsey in the writ panel. We were mindful of that. No, there are no cases on that, but logic, I think, prevails here in that. That there is no evidence in the record that at the time of disclosure that there was any intent whatsoever. What the record reflects is that in the fall, after the prime contractor's award, the day of award, we forwarded that information to them, said, can't wait to work with you, let's get together. It was only in October and November of 2011. Last disclosure was in May. October and November of 2011, when they submitted their prices to us, 25% profit margins. That's too high. When we understood that WWS didn't have the right security clearances, those are the reasons why this wasn't entered into. That's their evidence. I'm not talking about any of the evidence that we put on trial because this is our challenge to a motion to strike. So what they should have done, if that was really the case, is to do exactly what the NDA permits them to do. Probably the only good remedy in these NDAs is a temporary injunction immediately after this happens. And so if there was something that happened in May, as your hypothetical posed, the appropriate remedy was not to wait 2.5 years to sue, and a year and a half after what they're saying the violation is. It's to march into court and get a temporary injunction in circuit court, and they didn't do that. A couple of other points that I wanted to make. Counsel makes a point that these are not agreements that should be read together, but of course they should. This is all part of the same deal. They were entered into on the same date. It was for the purpose of the same procurement. Your Honor makes a good point about how they're dependent on one another. The teaming agreement itself references the NDA. This is Joint Appendix 555. The responsibilities and obligations of a signed non-disclosure agreement shall continue in force beyond the termination or expiration of this agreement. So these absolutely should be read together. And that is why this judgment is inconsistent, because the TEAMI agreement is unenforceable, and what forms the basis of that unenforceability also is the basis for the liability that's been imposed.
Can I ask you one last question?
Sure.
Back to the agreement to agree. Is it possible, though, in the government contracting community that 8A set-asides have a certain custom and usage in trade, and it would not be readily knowable to most people, but it would be implied extrinsic evidence you'd look at to cover up ambiguities in the contract? Not dissimilar, frankly, from what we do in UCC context, because that seems to be his best argument. What's the answer to that?
Maybe two parts to that. One, if that were the case, I would have loved to see an expert at trial say exactly that, because that's not a fact, that's an opinion. Two, in my experience, no, that's not at all the case. I read that as you did, and they had their kind of self-serving testimony that, well, no, when we say up to 49%, what we really meant was 49%, and that's what everyone in the world believes in these situations. If that were the case, and it wasn't here, if that were the case, then I think that it was incumbent upon on the appellees to get an expert on the stand that is knowledgeable in the industry and testify on behalf of the industry as an expert and say, well, no, when we mean this up to 49%, what this means in our industry is 49%. And that wasn't the case. There's no record of that whatsoever.
All right, your time has expired as well. Call the next case.